Welcome to the Kelly Patrick Show. Thank you for tuning in. In today's episode, I am joined by Cody Cook. Cody is the author of The Anarchist Anabaptist, Essays on Radical Christianity and Freedom. Cody is with the Libertarian Christian Institute. I really appreciate Cody coming on the show. If you're a fan of the Kelly Patrick Show, I ask that you please send some referrals the way of my sponsors.
Tim Gar here. The title sponsor of the show is Louisville Combat Academy, located at 7908 Beulah Church Road, Louisville, Kentucky, 40228. They have a great MMA program, offer 10-planted no-gi jiu-jitsu, female-friendly classes, and a great kids program. Check out Louisville Combat Academy. Kelly is there kickboxing every Thursday at 6:30 p.m. and for MMA sparring on Sundays at 5 p.m. Both classes are led by B.J. Ferguson, who, in 2023, for obvious reasons, won the Everything contest for most handsome MMA fighter on the planet. Come out and join Kelly for a class. Veercast Digital Media at veercastdigitalmedia.com. Matt McCarthy runs Veercast and is also the producer for the Kelly Patrick Show. They do video production, aerial drone photography, web design, and podcast production. Contact them at info@veercast.com to start your own video show or podcast. Kelly's health insurance practice in Louisville, Kentucky. Kelly is an independent broker and he loves referrals for anyone in the United States who needs help with Medicare, supplements, Advantage plans, and Part D drug plans. Kelly can also always help with life insurance, long-term care insurance, and group health insurance. Contact Kelly anytime via call or text 502-386-0978.
Welcome to the Kelly Patrick Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. In today's episode, I am joined by anarchist author Cody Cook. Is that a good introduction there, Cody?
Sure, works for me.
You'll take it. Anarchist or anarcho-author, whatever verbiage we want to use for that. Cody recently released The Anarchist Anabaptist that we're going to discuss today. But before we jump into the details of that exact book, Cody, could you introduce yourself to the Kelly Patrick Show audience? Why do you call yourself an anarchist? Does that mean, what does that word even mean? If I host a local podcast for like MMA here in the Kentucky area. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping we get people randomly tuning in. Maybe the word anarchy sounds scary to someone tuning in. Who is Cody Cook? Why do you associate with being called an anarchist?
Yeah, sure. So, who's Cody Cook? Right now, I do a lot of work with the Libertarian Christian Institute. I'm one of the co-hosts of their flagship podcast, Libertarian Christian Podcast. I've got a bachelor's and a master's in biblical studies and theology. And so as for what brings me to anarchism, so, I mean, it is kind of a scary word, I think, without a lot of definitions. I mean, the short, straightforward definition of anarchism would be without rulers, right? And so historically, anarchism has meant opposition to the state in particular and to authoritarian hierarchies in general. And so kind of a lot of the early anarchists were what we might call today anarcho-communists, the folks who believed in the social ownership of property and the destruction of class distinctions. But they just didn't want to use the state monopoly to achieve it, right? Excuse me. So now, not all of those kind of forms of early secular anarchism were communist. So there's this libertarian anarchism of the 19th century that you find in guys like Lysander Spooner, who was a slave abolitionist, and he was also more amenable to free markets. He's kind of what you might call like a center anarchist. So you have like the left anarchist, the anarcho-communists, and then Lysander Spooner is more in the center. And then over time, more in the 20th century, you have another form of secular anarchism that emerges within the libertarian tradition, what we call anarcho-capitalism. So that's more like kind of right, what you might call right-wing anarchism, right? And so all of them reject the state monopoly on violence, which is the idea that the state is allowed to do things that other people aren't allowed to do, right? So I can't steal from my neighbor, but the state can. I can't break into my neighbor's house and look for drugs, but the state can.
Even if we just dove into that, you describing it at this level is very good shit, because that can be applied. So you're saying you don't believe that just because it's the government that they should have the right to search your apartment or something like that, right? Just because they're the government, you don't just assume that it's a good thing.
Right. So an anarchist would basically say that there's not some special power that a certain group of people have that nobody else has. Right. We're all essentially equal. So they deny that sort of hierarchical approach to ethics where some people live by a different set of rules than others. And so now the left and right side of that just kind of has to do with, you know, what kind of society without rulers they want to build. I think the problem with anarcho-communism is that unless you're willing to use force against your neighbors, you know, there's not really a way to stop market transactions. And so, you know, I think ultimately an anarchist society is a libertarian society, and it's going to devolve, not devolve, but it's going to resolve itself, we'll say, into a free market kind of society. Now, generally, you know, anarchists on the right love free markets, they love free trade, and they generally subscribe to this libertarian principle, which is called the non-aggression principle. And it posits that the initiation of force is always wrong, whereas self and group defense would be morally justifiable. So I'm also from a kind of this strain of anarchism that's more Christian. So Christian anarchism also comes about in this anarchist tradition. Leo Tolstoy is one of the major figures in that movement, largely known as an author, but also a sort of a thinker in that Christian anarchist tradition.
Would Dorothy Day possibly fall into that?
Dorothy Day, yeah, she comes later than Tolstoy. She's a Catholic anarchist. Jocko Lull as well would be figures in that strain. There's also a guy who I think I'm probably more in sync with, a gentleman whose name was Werner Eller. And so he was an Anabaptist, like I am, but he also was really happy to use that word anarchist of himself. And so to introduce kind of more complexity in this, just to be clear, so when people think about anarchism, sometimes they think of like violence and stuff like that. And that is true among some of the early anarcho-communists, that they would be, you know, wouldn't be opposed to using force against, you know, people in power and that kind of thing. Christian anarchism has generally been pacifistic, although there are some Christians who sort of come into Christian anarchism through the kind of right-wing libertarian anarcho-capitalist thing, as opposed to kind of through that Christian space. And so they may not necessarily be pacifists. But you know, Anabaptists like myself would be. So
when someone hears you say that you associate yourself with Anabaptists who would be associated with pacifism.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of pejoratives associated with that.
Sure.
We have a MMA crowd here in Kentucky. Oh, this guy's a pussy.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah. So I think coming from as a libertarian Christian, and what I would sort of say is that each individual has a natural right to self-defense. But if you're a Christian, you also are encouraged to follow Christ. And so, you know, following Christ sometimes means that you give up your rights. So there's this kind of idea of kind of what you might call like a masculine Christianity that is more aggressive. But I don't really see Christ as a model of aggression. I see Christ as a model of loving your enemies, of being willing to turn the other cheek. And so if Christ is that model, even though you may have a right to self-defense, you're going to be sort of tempering the exercise of your rights in order to follow Christ better as your model. And so with the Anabaptists, maybe I'll define them a little bit. The Anabaptists were a group in the 16th century. They emerged from this Protestant Reformation, where you have these groups who are questioning the authority of the Catholic Church and they're wanting to go back to the Bible. And the Anabaptists were part of what would be called the Radical Reformation. And so what the Protestants kind of did was they sort of said they wanted to go back to the Bible, but they arguably went back really maybe to the 4th century to a guy named Augustine, who is a great thinker in the Western Church. But he shifted a lot of the way that a lot of the theology of the church kind of up to that time, because the early church was anti-war. It tended to be pacifistic. And so what the Anabaptists did was they sort of said, well, let's go back to the earliest church. Let's go back to the New Testament. Let's go back to the Sermon on the Mount. Let's do what the earliest Christians did. And so they were anti-war. They were opposed to the state. They wanted to be separate from it. They acknowledged that there was a role for governance that God was sort of using, but they basically said, our king is Christ. That's where our allegiance is.
Do you have any passages in particular that you have to defend against from the Bible? Isn't there one in Romans that talks about kind of the need for a government? But is there anything in particular that the Bible says about how we should partake in government that you commonly have to, answer questions regarding?
Yeah, Romans 13 is a big one. And it's a complicated passage, too, because on the surface, Paul seems to be saying something that we actually know he wouldn't believe. And it's a really complex issue because Romans 12 ends with Paul saying that Christians don't take vengeance, that we leave it to God, right? That we turn the other cheek, we love our neighbor, we love our enemies, so on and so forth. Instead of striking them or seeking vengeance, we do good to them. And we leave it to God, right? And so then in chapter 13, he gets into the state and he says, well, the state does use vengeance. And so on one hand, he's distinguishing what Christians do from what the state does. But he also goes on to say things about the state that, like I said, we know aren't true. So he says, for example, that if you do what's right, you'll have nothing to fear from the state. Now, Paul has at this point been beaten nearly to death multiple times. By people in authority. His history is a history of people who have been, abused and enslaved and, conquered and cruelly treated. And he also worships a guy who was killed, who he thinks was sinless, by the way, who was murdered by the Roman authorities and put on a cross. And so Paul knows that the state, that if you do what's right all the time, that doesn't mean the state's going to leave you alone. And so there is some complexity going on in what's going on in Romans 13. And scholars have looked at different ways to understand that. So some have said, well, maybe Paul is talking about the way that the state or governance should function ideally, that if you're doing what's right, it'll leave you alone. And so in that sense, Paul is kind of holding a mirror up to the state and saying, this is what you should be, but this is what you are. And they're not the same thing. And so there's perhaps, Paul is offering a subtle critique of the state without maybe being too explicit, knowing that there are certain dangers in a marginalized group. If the Romans are to find this letter that Paul has written that says, well, the state's supposed to do all these things, but they don't. And that means that they're going to be judged by God.
Interesting. Okay.
So, but those who are interested in that subject, I've written a little bit more on that elsewhere. And there's a podcast for Libertarian Christian podcast I did on Romans 13. I think it was called Problem Passages or something like that. But you could find that. And there's a little more detail. But I don't want to bore people with a lot of exegesis and Greek words. But
no, I don't. That is a fascinating thing. So you're making the case that the early churches oftentimes, and I guess this does spill over, of course, into the of course, your book, The Anarchist Anabaptist, Essays on Radical Christianity and Freedom, oftentimes their organization of their lifestyle would be consistent with a libertarian worldview.
Right. Yeah, and actually what I would argue is, so the Anabaptists are 16th century. We really start to get, so it's like 1500s. It's almost 200 years later before we get what we call the classical liberal tradition. And that's where libertarianism comes from. That's where that kind of libertarian anarchism comes from. And what I argue in the book is that the Anabaptists kind of figured it out almost 150 years before anybody else did. So what made them different from the Protestants is the Protestants were what you would call the magisterial reformers, and the Anabaptists were the radical reformers. And the distinction between those two is that where Catholics thought that church and state should be intertwined, so did Protestants. So Martin Luther sort of argued for this idea of freedom of conscience in the sense of I should be able to go back to the Bible and ignore what the Catholic Church has to say, but not the Anabaptists, but not the Catholics. And so it was this kind of thing where ultimately the Protestants and Catholics agreed on violence, on the state, on the connection of church and state. And the Anabaptists said, no, religion, not just religion, but especially Christianity, is voluntary. You can't follow Christ if you're being forced to. And so the reason they're called Anabaptists, it's a conjunction of two Greek words that means rebaptized. And so what they did was they baptized adults. And that was a pretty wild idea in the 16th century for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons was because when church and state are intertwined like that, baptism was not only entry into the church, it was entry into society. It was entry into the church state. And so these Anabaptists were essentially non-citizens. The only people who didn't get baptized in the 16th century Europe were Jews. And Jews were also not considered, you know, full citizens. And so you have these people who's, and part of the reason rationale for adult baptism is like, well, they're like, well, a baby can't make an informed decision to follow Christ. Right. And so all of this kind of blends together, this idea of voluntary faith, of rejecting violence, of rejecting the state and what it does, really informs that sort of Anabaptist mindset. Now, there's some ways in which they're very different from what you might think of as libertarians. A lot of times they shared property and lived together and that kind of thing, but they did so voluntarily. And so that's really the key thing, is that to be a libertarian does not necessarily mean that you have that, you know, I don't know, that you love corporations or that, you know, whatever. It just means that you believe that people should be free to make their own decisions, and that the only legitimate use of force is against people who are using force against others. And so the Anabaptists essentially believed that. They looked at what the magistrates were doing, what the state was doing, and they said, we think that you have a legitimate role. We're distinct from it because we don't believe in using violence, but at the same time, just because you have a legitimate role doesn't mean you can do whatever you want to do. And so in a lot of these early Anabaptist confessions and statements, you see them rejecting the idea of war for profit. You see them sort of saying, like, you know, if you're going after people because they believe the wrong things, you're doing something evil. And so they really wanted to limit largely what the state did to those kind of functions that we might sort of see. What minarchists in particular would sort of look at and say, like, okay, you're here to, not even minarchists, really, I guess, anarchists would say this too, that the only legitimate role of governance is to protect innocent people against force, right? Then that's largely how the Anabaptists saw it. There's a few exceptions, but basically that's how they looked at it.
What kind of a church do you attend?
Yeah, so I live in an area without any Anabaptist churches, unfortunately. I'm starting to get involved in a denomination called the Brethren in Christ, which is Anabaptist. And so I've made some connections there, and I'm hoping to work with them in the future. But at this point, I go to a non-denominational church in my small town and get to teach there. And so certainly my Anabaptist thought informs what I teach there, but I'm also not teaching in an Anabaptist environment.
And do you mind saying what part of the country are you in?
Yeah, I'm in Southwest Ohio.
Okay. Yep. Interesting.
So,
yeah,
so that's kind of my political and theological background and how it comes together. And essentially what I'm arguing in the book for those who are, maybe libertarian friendly or libertarians, is that especially if you're a Christian, is that there is this wellspring of thought that comes even before the libertarian movement that's really looking to root itself in just what the New Testament taught, you know. And obviously, you know, they were products of their time to some degree, but they were really interested in saying, what do we as Christians who are supposed to follow Christ, who are supposed to follow the New Testament, how do we live? And what they came up with looks a lot like what, you know, libertarians would end up arguing almost 200 years later.
Across the board, do you see the use of the Christian religion when it comes to politics, maybe Middle East foreign policy? Do you think the United States being a Christian nation, is that a big deal? Do you think that's used politically?
Yeah, it is. And there's this kind of sense that there's two ways you can approach this. Either you can have a Christian nation, or religion shouldn't inform politics at all. Right. That's the binary choice that you're presented with. So either we're a theocracy and we stone homosexuals and we do whatever, or we live in a society where religion has no impact. And what I would argue is that that the New Testament actually gives us a different model. Now, the New Testament tells us what the role of governance is, that God actually has a plan and purpose for governance, but that plan and purpose is not to punish pagans or to silence Jews or to stone homosexuals. It's very much limited to what we would sort of think in terms of natural rights, right? That we actually should want to live in a society that's relatively free, that we want to be able to preach the gospel to people who have a choice to reject it or accept it. And that we don't want to be using violence against our peaceful neighbors. And so I think that actually is the Christian model of governance that we derive from the New Testament, if we're thinking through it consistently. And so now the danger, of course, is that some people aren't going to see it that way. They're going to say, well, anything that the Bible commands Christians to do, if we're going to live in a Christian nation, we have to force non-Christians to do that. But that's not the point. Jesus does not say, force your neighbors to do this, and if they don't do it, kick them in the teeth. Jesus says, you do this, right? And so if you're a follower of Jesus, that, you know, you are supposed to follow those Christian imperatives. And if you're not a follower of Jesus, well, that's a different thing. And that's between, as Paul said, let God judge the outsiders. And so when we put the state in a position to judge, basically to arbitrate these sort of questions of discipleship, I don't think we're being Christian. So the idea that that's the really Christian thing to do, I just don't buy.
Now for my very hard-hitting question.
Okay.
Do you think the government should regulate abortion?
Yeah, that's a tough question. So yeah, I mean, so those who maybe aren't familiar with the way a lot of anarchists would kind of approach these kind of big questions. So like a lot of anarcho-capitalists, for example, would say that we would sort of get governance through competition in the market, right? So you may be familiar with some of these terms, but maybe your audience isn't. But like this idea of, I forgot the term. It's kind of a plurality of a polycentric law, right? And so that as these corporations are sort of competing and also having to work together, that this sort of common law emerges from that. Now, the trouble there is it's hard to imagine how a society like that would regulate abortion, because unborn babies are not usually customers of private security forces, right? And it seems that a lot of the people who would be customers would probably not want to be customers of a company that would regulate their ability to have an abortion if they wanted one. Now, my friend Carrie Baldwin, who works at the Libertarian Christian Institute, has done some work on this because she holds to that anarcho-capitalist position. And she does make some arguments for how that might work, how abortion might be regulated. I think that that model works a lot better than we might fear that it would, as people who haven't really lived in that kind of model and that we sort of fear change, you know, that we like the idea of the state because it's what we know. I'm kind of a little bit more inclined to think in terms of trying to build a common law that's based on the non-aggression principle. And so for me, I think that, private corporations competing and working together could play a part in that kind of society that we'd want to build. But I also don't really love the idea of saying, well, let's just let competition come in. Let's privatize everything. Let's get rid of the state. And we think that that will lead to a libertarian society. It's like, well, maybe, mostly. But like, I kind of like the idea of sort of starting from, let's build a society based on the non-aggression principle. And so in that kind of society, I would say, yeah, if you're initiating force against a baby that's in your womb that doesn't actually pose you any significant threat, that would be an act of aggression. And I would say that it would be a legitimate role of governance to try to regulate that. That's how I would answer that question.
What can you tell me about the Libertarian Christian Institute?
Yeah, so it was started by a gentleman named Norman Horn. He actually started originally as a blog, and it's kind of grown since then. At this point, there's a kind of a network of podcasters, of writers, people who work together. So at this point, it's more of a think tank than just like a Blogspot blog, which is what it was, I think, in the 2000s when he initially started it. And we are kind of different kinds of Christians. So there's Reformed Christians. I'm an Anabaptist in the group. We've got folks who are like kind of in the Church of Christ. There's a good friend of mine, Alex Bernardo, who's Methodist. we've had Catholics write for us. We don't have, I don't think, any Roman Catholics on staff, but that would be cool too. So what we're really trying to be is kind of a broad ecumenical kind of movement of Christians who agree that we shouldn't be building a society on force against peaceful people. And so we kind of work out what that means. Sometimes we disagree. Sometimes we disagree about policy, although sometimes we also just disagree about theology, but we still work together and get along. So it's been a good place to be involved then.
Another hard-hitting question.
Okay.
What?
When a guy hosts an MMA podcast tells me he's got a hard-hitting question.
What is your view on the immigration topic?
Yeah. I would say that the consistent libertarian viewpoint would be more in the vein of open borders, that if you have people who are coming in who don't actually pose a threat to anybody, that restricting their freedom of movement would not be a legitimate moral thing to do. Now, there are some libertarians who kind of argue for closed borders and kind of strange roundabout ways by sort of saying, well, yes, in a libertarian society, we would have open borders, but we can't really have open borders now for various reasons. And they might include, well, there's a welfare state, which is legitimate. I think that, you know, the way we do that is we just roll back the welfare state. But basically there are libertarians who will argue for a closed borders position. I don't think that's really the classical or consistent libertarian position, though. I think if you want to make an argument for, we've got to keep violent people out, we've got to keep out people who may be, you know, bringing deadly diseases or something like that, that's legitimate. That's fair. That's fair. But apart from that, I think, you know, letting people travel and work and, you know, so on and so forth, is, if they're peaceful, they don't pose anyone any harm, I think is the moral, legitimate Christian and libertarian position to take.
Okay. There's so many questions from a libertarian perspective that are, you know, of course, intriguing to my libertarian nerd brain. Are we just a bunch of nerds? Is that what we are, us libertarians?
Yeah, the joke is that we're all on the spectrum, right? Is that we have this sort of hyper fixated focus on these questions and how trying to build this sort of system that makes sense logically and how this all fits together. I think that is kind of the, you know, I remember seeing something about someone was criticizing who was a non-libertarian, there was like this town that was put together by a bunch of kind of libertarian nerds, and it didn't necessarily work as well as they'd hoped. And I kind of remember thinking, well, like, yeah, but that's not like a real society. Like, in a real society, you have nerds, you have regular people, you know what I mean? So like, I think building a society on libertarian principles is a little bit different than, let's just put a bunch of weird autistic libertarians together in a town and hope it works out. It's like, well, you kind of need a little more of a variety of people to make a society or a community work, in my opinion. But
Cody, you're a Christian. Do you support heroin being legal? Heroin addicts just walking all across the streets. I mean, who knows what kind of criminal activity. Is that what you support, Cody? Is that what you support?
Well, yeah, the unfortunate reality is that's the current situation. And so oftentimes people will criticize libertarianism, that libertarianism will bring about X, Y, or Z. And often what they're saying, what they're concerned about, is what's already happening. And so the question is, would more freedom create a worse problem? And so I guess my answer to that is, let's look back at alcohol, right? So we had this prohibitionist movement. Christians were kind of largely spearheading that. They looked at the situation where you had alcoholics who were, you know, going out and spending all their money instead of taking care of their kids. They were, you know, coming home drunk and beating on their kids or wife or whatever. And they said, this is horrible. This is immoral. The Christian thing to do is, we've got to ban this, right? And look at what happened as a result. We created the cartels. We created these mobs of illegal alcohol sales. And in addition, because it wasn't on the open market, you didn't have the same sort of forces of, you know, not even necessarily government regulation, but just kind of oversight. The fact that it was sort of public and everybody could sort of see what was going on. And so once we made alcohol legal again, we not only took it out of the hands of the cartels, but we increased the quality and the safety of it. And so, yes, I do think that in a society where we have less cartels, where we have less, you know, illegal drug sales going on, but actually no illegal drug sales going on, and where the quality and the safety of what's being produced would be much higher, would be a better society than the society we currently live in.
Are you just saying that because you want to do heroin yourself?
No, I guess I could do heroin myself right now if I wanted to. I just have to be sneaky about it. But I don't drink. When I was in high school, I had a period where I smoked pot, but only for political reasons. It was because I wanted to be like a 1960s hippie. So like, I grew my hair long and smoked pot, and it didn't mean the same thing in the 2000s, but you know, that was the model that I was trying to imitate. So yeah, I'm not into that at all personally. But yeah, I think it would be better if people who did struggle with addiction were less likely to overdose and die from it.
Cody, in your libertarian utopian world that I guess you just have everything all figured out, who would even build the roads?
That's a great question. Walter Block's got a good book on that. And Bob Murphy, who actually I just spoke to not long ago, has also written on that in his book, Chaos Theory. So there's different answers to that question. If we go back to the anarcho-capitalist question, ultimately, if there is a need for something or a desire for something, then I think the market will produce it. So that could be private roads, for example. So maybe you pay a toll, or you have a subscription fee, or maybe advertisements would be used to help sort of pay for the maintenance of these roads. And so that would make them at least profitable enough that private companies would want to invest in them. Like I said, I'm kind of okay with going back to an idea of, I mean, for me, anarcho-capitalism is not really my center. Like, I like capitalism. I'm an anarchist. But I don't think that the anarcho-capitalist answer is, well, just privatize everything and then it will work out. And to me, like, I would probably call myself more like a voluntarist. There's all these kind of subterms within the anarchist community and libertarian community. And to be a voluntarist means that, I don't really care how we do it. It just has to be voluntary. And so, like, if a community wants to get together and kind of keep the roads up to date and that kind of thing, but without taxing people, without stealing the money, that's perfectly legitimate. I don't necessarily think everything has to be privatized in order to build that kind of society. So there are different answers. And like I said, sometimes these answers sound really strange when it's not what you're used to hearing.
That actually doesn't sound strange. So you're not opposed to, kind of like you were talking about with the Anabaptist communities, they kind of have public communities within their own little world, but it's all on a voluntary basis. You're applying that to the roads. You don't need everything to be paid for by different individuals on a privatized basis every time. There can be somewhat community-based solutions. As long as they're done on a voluntary basis, they get the thumbs up from Cody.
Yeah. And I think, in an ideal voluntary society, you'd have a mix of both. I think you'd have private markets doing a lot more than they're doing now. But I think you'd also have some of that happening as well. Yeah. And people say, this couldn't work in reality. I always sort of say, well, look at the Amish or look at the Hutterites, look at these Anabaptist communities, because they show that it can actually work. And incidentally, they also don't use violence to maintain their communities. So that was a unique distinction of the Anabaptists. Like, we think of, like shunning, for example, as kind of a negative thing now, kind of judgmental or whatever. But at the time when the Anabaptists were saying we should shun, they were getting it from the New Testament, first of all. And they were also using it in the context of a society where, Protestants and Catholics, if they had heretics, they killed them. They tortured them. And if they didn't repent, they killed them. Anabaptists sort of said, well, we'll shun you. And then if we have to, we might push you out of the community. And then you're sort of the world's problem. And so that was how they sort of managed some of those issues. Now, that doesn't maybe scale entirely, right? But because eventually, if everything's libertarian, there's really no place to push people. But they did sort of make this distinction once again between the church and the world. And in the church, violence wasn't used. And that was a strong distinction that they made. But they also, like I said, they accepted the fact that there was this other realm that was maybe a separate kingdom that wasn't really the Christian kingdom, and that kingdom did use violence. But once again, they also sort of felt that there were limits that should be imposed on when that violent, what kind of violence was acceptable and when it could be used.
On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most libertarian possible, 1, of course, being, 1, 0 being 0. Mm-hmm. Where would you rate on a libertarian scale, Joe Biden, and where would you rate Donald Trump?
Man. Yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of depends on what we put at zero, right? So, like, if we're putting Joseph Stalin or Genghis Khan at zero, then that would make Trump and Biden look a lot better, right? But if we're putting, Angela Merkel or something, that would look different. I mean, ultimately, what we've inherited in the West is this liberal tradition that kind of assumes libertarianism in a lot of ways, but it just makes a lot of exceptions, right? We say, yes, freedom of speech, of course. Yes, free markets, of course, but, right? And so it's just really a question of how many buts we put on there, because ultimately, you know, Biden and Trump are both part of that classical liberal tradition in the broadest sense. They've inherited that Western viewpoint. What's kind of strange is that, like, over time, I think the Democrats were a lot more opposed to free markets years ago because they had white labor in their pockets. And once white labor moved to the right, what you've sort of seen is the Democratic Party has gotten kind of more open to free markets, and the right has gotten more opposed to it, because they want to sort of protect, you know, American jobs. They want to stop immigrants from coming in and taking work. They want to, you know, bring back the 1950s through tariffs and that kind of stuff. So I guess
And do you think that's bad?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think a free society and a free world is a good thing. And
even if it enriches a country like China, and it's not maximizing the rate at which we are enriching our country.
Yeah, so what I would say is, like, there's one area in which I might, like, kind of accept tariffs a little bit, which is, like, we'll impose tariffs on countries that don't respect basic human rights. Like, maybe I could see that argument, right?
but we don't even make that argument.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
But I think that would be kind of fair, right?
Okay.
But apart from that, like, I mean, I think if you look at the lives of people in China and how they've been improved through trade, or even just more broadly.
Not the Uyghurs, but the general
people. Yes, not the Uyghurs, unfortunately. Yeah, that's the downside. Yeah, but you look at the last, you know, couple hundred years and compare it to the last 6,000 years, and you can see what these ideas of classical liberalism, of free markets, have done to the world. And they've been, I mean, incredibly positive in terms of, you look at the way, like, extreme poverty has just been eviscerated. How it used to be that, like, I don't know, I want to say something like, you know, 80% of the world lived in extreme poverty. And now it's more like 10. And maybe this, I don't have those figures right in my head, but there's, I do mention them in the book, The Anarchist Anabaptist. But so, I mean, ultimately, when you look at the lives of poor people all over the world, free markets have increased their quality of life hugely, significantly. So some would say miraculously. And so, like, I do think that's ultimately a very good thing. And the other side of it is, you know, as these countries are developing, they may have rough starts, just like we had, right? Just like the West had, just like America had and Great Britain had. The Industrial Revolution was kind of a mixed bag for some of the people experiencing it, because they had to work out some of those details. But over time, we've entered into a world that's far more fair, that's far more charitable, that's far more generous, that respects human rights, you know. And so, you know, a lot of those kind of birth pangs we look back on and we say that was horrible. And we might say the same thing today. We look at, like, sweatshops in different countries and we say, oh man, that's horrible. But, like, if we're not talking about slavery, we're talking about people who choose to come to work. And there's a reason they do it, because their lives are better. And so if people are making voluntary choices, even if they choose something that we would say, well, that's not really ideal, well, it's better than the alternative, or they wouldn't pick it. And then, so that's one side of it. But the other side of it is, just look at what's resulted from it. And I think, you know, free trade has enriched everyone. And so the argument I think that we really want to try to make is, well, we don't necessarily care about the enrichment of the rest of the world. We're okay with shutting down trade and allowing China and Russia to pick up our old trading partners and then use those alliances against us. And we also are okay with all of our goods costing more and of basically not being able to get certain things very easily, and maybe creating a black market of, you know, bananas coming in. But we're willing to do all that and forgo all that, that advancement for ourselves and for the world, and low prices for us and easy trade for us, because we might be able to bring back certain industries that died out 70 years ago. I don't know. I don't think that's worth it, in my opinion.
I have Democrat friends who would make the argument that tariffs can be good.
Mm.
The way Trump did them,
mm-hmm,
in such a reckless manner, that's the problem, guys. Okay, so I have these Democrat friends who, they, of course, yeah, if I criticize Trump, they like me then. So I'm anti the tariffs when Trump imposes them. They're like, oh, yeah, you're right, Kelly. He's just doing them wrong. What do you think of that type of analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I think what makes Trump sort of unique as a person is that, or as a politician, I guess, as a leader, is that he doesn't really respect the way things have been done, right? And so that can be good and it can be bad, because the way things have been done has often been really horrible. It's been like the military industrial complex, that kind of foreign policy establishment, and that really sucks. But there was also a process, right? And so Trump sort of saying I don't care about the process, I'm going to do whatever I want. It's good and bad, because sometimes he might do something that no one would have ever done before, because there's a process and there's a consensus. Obama was fine, would criticize Bush's wars on the campaign trail, but then this first day in office, he sits down with the Secretary of State or whatever, and the Secretary of Defense and the Pentagon, and they say, yeah, sounds great, that's not how we do things here, pal. And Donald Trump said, well, I'm the president, they voted for me, who cares? And so there is something to be said about the kind of recklessness sometimes with which he approaches things. So I look at Doge, and there's a lot that I like in Doge, but I think that the two things that maybe are going to be tough about it is, one is it is being done haphazardly. And I think that that's going to, you kind of unplug things before you realize what they're doing. And so I think there's better ways to go about it, thoughtfully. And you sort of give time for, it's like you shut down a malaria hospital or something, and you do it in a day. And it's okay, well, yes, we agree private charities should be doing this, but let's give them time to mobilize, right? So there is something about that, but there's also this whole idea that Trump says, well, maybe this isn't constitutional and maybe the courts will challenge it, and so all of this will go away, but whatever.
Yeah, and that's a big one for me too, is it seems like a lot of the stuff that's being done Javier Milei style,
right,
it's going to be reversed because of the systems we have in place here. So who wins there?
Yeah, because we're not Argentina. Argentina is much more of a kind of executive-oriented state, right? They have a Congress and everything, but most of those decisions are really made by the lone executive. That's not how we've done things, and that's good and that's bad. It means that on the one hand, it's really hard to do something really awful unless you can get buy-in, but it also means it's really hard to do something really good unless you get buy-in. And so largely things kind of stay the same, or they sort of slowly ramp up and just, we just kind of get more and more state over time. Because nobody wants to be the guy who, cuts a bunch of jobs and loses votes and makes people sad. So it's just sort of that slow build. It's really tough from a libertarian perspective to know how to rate Trump, because, he thinks with his gut, he does what he wants, and sometimes that looks libertarian, and sometimes that really doesn't look libertarian.
So would you give Biden a 0 and Trump a 1 or something like that? Or what do you think? Something along those lines? Or,
yeah, like I said, it kind of just depends on where you put the scale. I mean, I think I'd...
It's a difficult question, I admit. It's kind of... ask what you could call douchebag questions, where I put people on the spot and, make you answer questions that are, annoying, I'm sure.
It depends on if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Mussolini is at 0, right?
Okay. Maybe Elon Musk is more of a libertarian than Trump, you think?
I would say so. I mean, I think he has some of those same kind of impulses of let's just do it and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I think he's kind of, he's like a lot of, CEO types, that kind of man of action, I'm going to do what I want type thing. But he at least is interested in those arguments. Like he's going to maybe post the Milton Friedman video.
He does. He's smart about virtue. He's kind of, you could say he's virtue signaling to nerds like you and I.
He may be, yeah.
Yeah, he'll share a Ron Paul. He'll retweet something, a Ron Paul quote. Everybody in our world is like, oh my God, I love Elon.
Yeah, or to say inflation is a tax.
Sure.
100% true. Nobody says it except libertarians.
Or to say tariffs.
Right.
Or a tax, I think I've seen him say. I mean, that's a good one.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I don't know about if he said it just like that, but I mean, he has not been, at certain points, as big of a fan about the tariffs. I don't know how that works out between Trump. The tariff stuff seems to be kind of a Trump negotiating tool. I don't deny that.
Yeah.
Now, my MAGA friends are like, Kelly, just be patient. He's playing 4D chess. And I don't buy that. I think it brings us back to the first term. Was Trump's first term, would you say that was a libertarian, prudent, fiscally conservative, prudent 4 years, would you say, Cody?
No, not at all. And in fact, the budget bill that he just forced through and threatened to get Thomas Massie primaried over his rejection of it, added money to the budget. And it fully funded the Department of Education that he supposedly just got rid of with an executive order. So like it's just this completely sort of scattershot approach that just it's not at all libertarian, but I think it's populism, right? And so populism doesn't fall onto a right or left paradigm. It doesn't fit neatly on that. It's really, so, you know, it's populism versus elitism. And
yeah,
you know, there's kind of elites on the right. There's elites on the left. There's populists on the left. There's a lot of people who jumped ship after Bernie Sanders got robbed of the Democratic nomination. And they went to Trump because Sanders and Trump share that populist sensibility. And sometimes that looks kind of libertarian. Sometimes that might mean, you know, we're going to push back against the elites and we're going to cut things and we're going to get rid of this waste or whatever. But you know, sometimes it looks like, we're going to put people in gulags.
Some reason I've been listening to the Gavin Newsom podcast lately. I don't know.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I don't know what's wrong with me, but he had, Steve Bannon on. Mm.
Oh, really? I would listen to that.
Yeah, right. Kind of fascinating. And yeah, they're both populists. They're kind of populist, right? Yeah. So you get to hear about, you know, of course, I don't really probably agree much with either of them, but it's fascinating to hear. That's kind of populism. That's what it is. And to see them trying, at least humoring the idea of them being friendly to each other and stuff like that was fascinating because, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's really not that far off.
It's not, and I think populism relies a lot on identity politics, and we talk about this happening on the left, but it's really a right-wing phenomenon too. The idea of the kind of, you know, the white guy who doesn't have the job he used to, or that his dad had, or that his grandfather had, that he feels like he's sort of been left, set aside, he's been forgotten. That's an identity politics argument. And, it's the kind of argument that you're going to hear a lot more on the right. The left will just make the same arguments, but appeal to women or minorities or.
And J.D. Vance is exactly really that.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the hillbilly elegy type. That's kind of his shtick is kind of underprivileged white guy, which I'm not doubting, you know, that he came from. I saw his movie, you know, the wife and I watched the movie, and it was fascinating. Doesn't look like he had the most pleasant childhood. I don't doubt that. But it really is a brand of populism or identity politics, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it is. But there was a time, I think, you know, because he was that kind of success story, you know, who, I think he became an elite, right? And so he was one of those people who was early on saying like, you know, well, there's some good things we can learn from Trump, but basically this guy's a jerk and he's a moron and he's got a bad attitude and he says horrible things. And, but then I think he licked his finger and held it up against the wind and said, maybe I'll jump on this Trump train and see where it carries me.
Good thing he did. He wouldn't be the vice president if he didn't change tune on that. That's that's just the game that, you know, that's what they're signing up for. I mean, there's no way he would be the vice president.
Right.
If he didn't change his tune about Trump, obviously.
Yeah. Which is also kind of weird too. I mean, it's this idea that I think all you really have to do to get on the Trump train is to pledge fealty.
Correct. Joe Rogan did it. And then you saw they're like buddies all of a sudden. Oh, I'm not going to vote for Trump. Or the Kyle, what's the shooter? The guy who shot, what's his name?
Rittenhouse.
He did that. Remember, he said he was going to write in Ron Paul. Everybody bailed on him. Oh, fuck you, Rittenhouse. We hate you. Then he did end up, kissing the ring, voted for Trump. Now he's in the good graces. I mean, that's just all it takes.
Yeah, or look at all the tech CEOs that showed up at the inauguration. I mean, that's, you know, they weren't Trump people originally, right? I mean, but they knew where things were going because they spent the last 8 years getting the crap kicked out of them by both the right and the left. Saying, you know, we're going to regulate you if you don't do this. We're going to regulate you if you don't shut down speech. We're going to regulate you if you don't allow right wing speech or whatever. Right, and it's just like. I think that they've learned their lesson and they've also jumped on the Trump train. And to me, like that really, we're not talking about something that's significantly different in that sense. You know, like it's, I think in some senses it's worse that, that's not a way in which we're moving in a more libertarian direction where you have to kiss the ass of, the president in order to be left alone. You know, that's not libertarianism. So he's not. So sometimes he'll do libertarian things, but he just doesn't. He's not principled about it. You know.
Yeah. Sounds yeah. like a good description. Cody, if someone's interested in buying the book, once again, it is The Anarchist Anabaptist Essays on Radical Christianity and Freedom. How can they buy the book?
Yep. It's on Amazon. It's on Audible as well for an audiobook. So you can get it at libertarianchristians.com. You can get it at Amazon, or I've got links, info to buy, interviews, different stuff like that, all at anarchistanabaptist.com as well. So that's kind of a good landing page for just kind of a clearinghouse of what's going on with the book.
And I'm looking at you here on Twitter. It's at Cantus Firmus CC. Is that right?
Yeah, which is hard to spell, but that's kind of the name of my personal blog, is Cantus Firmus. So it's Latin. So yeah, that was a dumb decision on my part to call it that. But yes, I am on Twitter, and you could look me up there. If you want to put it in like the show notes or whatever, that would be fine.
Very good tweet you have there. It says, your pinned tweet, I think, is a good one. It says, if anarchy is so bad, then how come Outback Steakhouse has no rules and it's just right? That's pretty good.
Thank you. I don't know if they still use that slogan anymore. That might date me a little bit, but...
Cody, I appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, man. Thanks, Kelly.